A person's food preferences, like his or her personality, are formed during the first few years of life through a process of socialization. Toddlers can learn to enjoy hot and spicy food, bland health food, or fast food, depending upon what the people around them eat. The human sense of smell is still not fully understood and can be greatly affected by psychological factors and expectations. The color of a food can determine the perception of its taste. The mind filters out the overwhelming majority of chemical aromas that surround us, focusing intently on some, ignoring others. People can grow accustomed to bad smells or good smells. They stop noticing what once seemed overpowering. Aroma and memory are somehow inextricably linked. A smell can suddenly evoke a long-forgotten moment. The flavors of childhood foods seem to leave an indelible mark, and adults often return to them without always knowing why. These comfort foods become a source of pleasure and reassurance, a fact that fast food chains work hard to promote. Childhood memories of happy meals can translate into frequent adult visits to McDonald's, like those of the chain's heavy users, the customers who eat there 4 or 5 times a week. The human craving for flavor has been a largely unacknowledged and unexamined force in history. Royal empires have been built, unexplored lands have been traversed, great religions and philosophies have been forever changed by the spice trade. In 1492, Christopher Columbus set sail to find seasoning. Today, the influence of flavor in the world marketplace is no less decisive. The rise and fall of corporate empires, of soft drink companies, snack food companies, and fast food chains is frequently determined by how their products taste. The quality that people seek most of all in a food, its flavor, is usually present in a quantity too infinitesimal to be measured by any traditional culinary terms, such as ounces or teaspoons. Today's sophisticated spectrometers, gas chromatographs, and headspace vapor analyzers provide a detailed map of a food's flavor components, detecting chemical aromas in amounts as low as 1 part per billion. The human nose, however, is still more sensitive than any machine yet invented. A nose can detect aromas present in quantities of a few parts per trillion, an amount equivalent to 0.000000000003%. Complex aromas, like those of coffee or roasted meat, may be composed of volatile gases from nearly 1,000 different chemicals. The smell of a strawberry arises from the interaction of at least 350 different chemicals that are present in minute amounts. The chemical that provides the dominant flavor of bell pepper can be tasted in amounts as low as 0.02 parts per billion. One drop is sufficient to add flavor to 5 average-sized swimming pools. The flavor additive usually comes last or second to last in a processed food's list of ingredients. Chemicals that add color are frequently used in even smaller amounts. As a result, the flavor of a processed food often costs less than its packaging. Soft drinks contain a larger proportion of flavor additives than most products. The flavor in a 12-ounce can of Coke costs about 0.5 cents. The Food and Drug Administration does not require flavor companies to disclose the ingredients of their additives, so long as all the chemicals are considered by the agency to be GRAS, generally regarded as safe. This lack of public disclosure enables the companies to maintain the secrecy of their formulas. It also hides the fact that flavor compounds sometimes contain more ingredients than the foods being given their taste. The ubiquitous phrase, artificial strawberry flavor, gives little hint of the chemical wizardry and manufacturing skill that can make a highly processed food taste like a strawberry. A typical strawberry flavor, like the kind found in a Burger King strawberry milkshake, contains the following ingredients: amyl acetate, amyl butyrate, amyl valerate, anethol, anisyl formate, benzyl acetate, benzyl isobutyrate, butyric acid, cinnamyl isobutyrate, cinnamyl valerate, cognac essential oil, diacetyl, dipropyl ketone, ethyl butyrate, ethyl cinnamate, ethyl heptanoate, ethyl heptalate, ethyl lactate, ethyl methylphenylglycidate, ethyl nitrate, ethyl propionate, ethyl valerate, heliotropin, hydroxyphenyl 2-butanone, 10% solution in alcohol, A-ionone, isobutyl anthranolate, isobutyl butyrate, lemon essential oil, maltol, 4-methylacetophenone, methylanthranolate, methylbenzoate, methylcinnamate, methylheptene carbonate, methylnaphthol ketone, methylsalicylate, mint essential oil, neroli essential oil, nerolin, neryl isobutyrate, orris butter, phenethyl alcohol, rose, rum ether, vanillin, and solvent. Although flavors usually arise from a mixture of many different volatile chemicals, a single compound often supplies the dominant aroma. Smelled alone, that chemical provides an unmistakable sense of the food. Ethyl 2-methylbutyrate, for example, smells just like an apple. Today's highly processed foods offer a blank palate. Whatever chemicals you add to them will give them specific tastes. Adding methyl 2-pyridyl ketone makes something taste like popcorn. Adding ethyl 3-hydroxybutanoate makes it taste like marshmallow. The possibilities are now almost limitless. Without affecting the appearance or nutritional value, processed foods could even be made with aroma chemicals such as hexanol, the smell of freshly cut grass, or 3-methylbutanoic acid, the smell of body odor. The 1960s were the heyday of artificial flavors. The synthetic versions of flavor compounds were not subtle, but they did not need to be, given the nature of most processed food. For the past 20 years, food processors have tried hard to use only natural flavors in their products. According to the FDA, these must be derived entirely from natural sources, from herbs, spices, fruits, vegetables, beef, chicken, yeast, bark, roots, etc. Consumers prefer to see natural flavors on a label out of a belief that they are healthier. The distinction between artificial and natural flavors can be somewhat arbitrary and absurd, based more on how the flavor has been made than on what it actually contains. A natural flavor, says Terry Acree, a professor of food science technology at Cornell University, is a flavor that's been derived with an out-of-date technology. Natural flavors and artificial flavors sometimes contain exactly the same chemicals, produced through different methods. Amyl acetate, for example, provides the dominant note of banana flavor. When you distill it from bananas with a solvent, amyl acetate is a natural flavor. When you produce it by mixing vinegar with amyl alcohol, adding sulfuric acid as a catalyst, amyl acetate is an artificial flavor. Either way, it smells and tastes the same. The phrase natural flavor is now listed among the ingredients of everything from Stonyfield Farm organic strawberry yogurt to Taco Bell hot taco sauce. A natural flavor is not necessarily healthier or purer than an artificial one. When almond flavor, benzaldehyde, is derived from natural sources, such as peach and apricot pits, it contains traces of hydrogen cyanide, a deadly poison. Benzaldehyde derived through a different process by mixing oil of clove and the banana flavor amyl acetate does not contain any cyanide. Nevertheless, it's legally considered an artificial flavor and sells at a much lower price. Natural and artificial flavors are now manufactured at the same chemical plants, places that few people would associate with Mother Nature. Calling any of these flavors natural requires a flexible attitude toward the English language and a fair amount of irony. The small and elite group of scientists who create most of the flavor in most of the food now consumed in the United States are called flavorists. They draw upon a number of disciplines in their work, biology, psychology, physiology, and organic chemistry. A flavorist is a chemist with a trained nose and a poetic sensibility. Flavors are created by blending scores of different chemicals in tiny amounts, a process governed by scientific principles, but demanding a fair amount of art. In an age when delicate aromas, subtle flavors, and microwave ovens do not easily coexist, the job of the flavorist is to conjure illusions about processed food, and, in the words of one flavor company's literature, to ensure consumer likability. In order to give a processed food the proper taste, a flavorist must always consider the food's mouthfeel, the unique combination of textures and chemical interactions that affects how the flavor is perceived. The mouthfeel can be adjusted through the use of various fats, gums, starches, emulsifiers, and stabilizers. The aroma chemicals of a food can be precisely analyzed, but mouthfeel is much harder to measure. How does one quantify a French fry's crispness? Food technologists are now conducting basic research in rheology, a branch of physics that examines the flow and deformation of materials. A number of companies sell sophisticated devices that attempt to measure mouthfeel. The Universal TA-XT2 Texture Analyzer, produced by the Texture Technology Corporation, performs calculations based on data derived from 25 separate probes. It's essentially a mechanical mouth. It gauges the most important rheological properties of a food: the bounce, creep, breaking point, density, crunchiness, chewiness, gumminess, lumpiness, rubberiness, springiness, slipperiness, smoothness, softness, wetness, juiciness, spreadability, springback, and tackiness. Some of the most important advances in flavor manufacturing are now occurring in the field of biotechnology. Complex flavors are being made through fermentation, enzyme reactions, fungal cultures, and tissue cultures. All of the flavors being created through these methods, including the ones being synthesized by funguses, are considered natural flavors by the FDA. The new enzyme-based processes are responsible for extremely lifelike dairy flavors. One company now offers not just butter flavor, but also fresh creamy butter, cheesy butter, milky butter, savory melted butter, and super concentrated butter flavor in liquid or powder form. The development of new fermentation techniques, as well as new techniques for heating mixtures of sugar and amino acids, have led to the creation of much more realistic meat flavors. The McDonald's Corporation will not reveal the exact origin of the natural flavor added to its French fries. In response to inquiries from Vegetarian Journal, however, McDonald's did acknowledge that its fries derive some of their characteristic flavor from animal products. In a meeting room at IFF, Brian Granger let me sample some of the company's flavors. It was an unusual taste test. There wasn't any food to taste. Granger is a senior flavorist at IFF, a soft-spoken chemist with graying hair, an English accent, and a fondness for understatement. He could easily be mistaken for a British diplomat or the owner of a West End brasserie with 2 Michelin stars. Like many in the flavor industry, he has an old-world, old-fashioned sensibility which seems out of step with our brand-conscious, egocentric age. Granger had brought a dozen small glass bottles from the lab. After he opened each bottle, I dipped a fragrance testing filter into it. The filters were long white strips of paper designed to absorb aroma chemicals without producing off notes. Before placing the strips of paper before my nose, I closed my eyes. Then I inhaled deeply, and one food after another was conjured from the glass bottles. I smelled fresh cherries, black olives, sautéed onions, and shrimp. Granger's most remarkable creation took me by surprise. After closing my eyes, I suddenly smelled a grilled hamburger. The aroma was uncanny, almost miraculous. It smelled like someone in the room was flipping burgers on a hot grill. But when I opened my eyes, there was just a narrow strip of white paper and a smiling flavorist. At the height of the potato harvest, I visited the Lamb Weston plant in American Falls, Idaho. It's one of the biggest fry factories in the world and makes French fries for McDonald's. It has a production capacity more than 3 times larger than that of the Simplot plant in Aberdeen. It's a state-of-the-art processing facility where raw commodities and man-made additives are combined to make America's most popular food. Lamb Weston was founded in 1950 by F. Gilbert Lamb, the inventor of a crucial piece of French fry-making technology. The Lamb water gun knife uses a high-pressure hose to shoot potatoes at a speed of 117 feet per second through a grid of sharpened steel blades, thereby creating perfectly sliced French fries. After coming up with the idea, Gil Lamb tested the first water gun knife in a company parking lot, shooting potatoes out of a fire hose. Lamb sold his company to ConAgra in 1988. Lamb Weston now manufactures more than 130 different types of French fries. Bud Mandeville, the plant manager, led me up a narrow wooden staircase inside one of the plant storage buildings. On the top floor, the staircase led to a catwalk, and beneath my feet, I saw a mound of potatoes that was 20 feet deep and 100 feet wide and almost as long as 2 football fields. The building was cool and dark, kept year-round at a steady 46 degrees. In the dim light, the potatoes looked like grains of sand on a beach. This was one of 7 storage buildings on the property. Outside, tractor trailers arrived from the fields carrying potatoes that had just been harvested. The trucks dumped their loads onto spinning rods that brought the larger potatoes into the building and let the small potatoes, dirt, and rocks fall to the ground. The rods led to a rock trap, a tank of water in which the potatoes floated and the rocks sank to the bottom. The plant used water systems to float potatoes gently this way and that way, guiding different sizes out of different holding bays, then flushing them into a 3-foot-deep stream that ran beneath the cement floor. The interior of the processing plant was gray, massive, and well-lit, with huge pipes running along the walls, steel catwalks, workers in hard hats, and plenty of loud machinery. If there weren't potatoes bobbing and floating past, you might think the place was an oil refinery. Conveyor belts took the wet, clean potatoes into a machine that blasted them with steam for 12 seconds, boiled the water under their skins, and exploded their skins off. Then the potatoes were pumped into a preheat tank and shot through a Lamb water gun knife. They emerged as shoestring fries. 4 video cameras scrutinized them from different angles, looking for flaws. When a French fry with a blemish was detected, an optical sorting machine time-sequenced a single burst of compressed air that knocked the bad fry off the production line and onto a separate conveyor belt, which carried it to a machine with tiny automated knives that precisely removed the blemish. And then the fry was returned to the main production line. Sprays of hot water blanched the fries, gusts of hot air dried them, and 25,000 pounds of boiling oil fried them to a slight crisp. Air cooled by compressed ammonia gas quickly froze them. A computerized sorter divided them into 6-pound batches, and a device that spun like an out-of-control lazy Susan used centrifugal force to align the French fries so that they all pointed in the same direction. The fries were sealed in brown bags, then the bags were loaded by robots into cardboard boxes, and the boxes were stacked by robots onto wooden pallets. Forklifts driven by human beings took the pallets to a freezer for storage. Inside that freezer, I saw 20 million pounds of French fries, most of them destined for McDonald's. The boxes of fries stacked 30 feet high, the stacks extending for roughly 40 yards, and the freezer was half empty. Every day, about 12 railroad cars and about 24 tractor trailers pulled up to the freezer, loaded up with French fries, and departed for McDonald's restaurants in Boise, Pocatello, Phoenix, Salt Lake City, Denver, Colorado Springs, and points in between. Near the freezer was a laboratory where women in white coats analyzed French fries day and night, measuring their sugar content, their starch content, their color. During the fall, Lamb Weston added sugar to the fries. In the spring, it leached sugar out of them. The goal was to maintain a uniform taste and appearance throughout the year. Every half hour, a new batch of fries was cooked in fryers identical to those used in fast food kitchens. A middle-aged woman in a lab coat handed me a paper plate full of premium extra longs, the type of French fries sold at McDonald's, and a salt shaker and some ketchup. The fries on the plate looked wildly out of place in this laboratory setting, this surreal food factory with its computer screens, digital readouts, shiny steel platforms, and evacuation plans in case of ammonia gas leaks. The French fries were delicious, crisp and golden brown, made from potatoes that had been in the ground that morning. I finished them and asked for more. On the Range. Hank was the first person I met in Colorado Springs. He was a prominent local rancher, and I'd called him to learn how development pressures and the dictates of the fast food industry were affecting the area's cattle business. In July of 1997, he offered to give me a tour of the new subdivisions that were rising on land where cattle once roamed. We met in the lobby of my hotel. Hank was 42 years old and handsome enough to be a Hollywood cowboy, tall and rugged, wearing blue jeans, old boots, and a big white hat. But the Dodge minivan he drove didn't quite go with that image, and he was too smart to fit any stereotype. Hank proved to be good company from the first handshake. He had strong opinions, but didn't take himself too seriously. We spent hours driving around Colorado Springs, looking at how the New West was burying the old. As we drove through neighborhoods like Broadmoor Oaks and Broadmoor Bluffs, amid the foothills of Cheyenne Mountain, Hank pointed out that all these big new houses on small lots sat on land that every few generations burned. The houses were surrounded by lovely pale brown grasses, tumbleweed, and scrub oak, ideal kindling. As in Southern California, these hillsides could erupt in flames with the slightest spark, a cigarette tossed from a car window. The homes looked solid and prosperous, gave no hint of their vulnerability, and had wonderful views. Hank's ranch was about 20 miles south of town. As we headed there, the landscape opened up and began to show glimpses of the true West, the wide-open countryside that draws its beauty from the absence of people, attracts people, and then slowly loses its appeal. Through leadership positions in a variety of local and statewide groups, Hank was trying to bridge the gap between ranchers and environmentalists to establish some common ground between longtime enemies. He was not a wealthy New Age type playing at being a cowboy. His income came from the roughly 400 head of cattle on his ranch. He didn't care what was politically correct and had little patience for urban environmentalists who vilified the cattle industry. In his view, good ranchers did far less damage to the land than city dwellers. "Nature isn't an abstraction for me," he said. "My family lives with it every day." When we got to the ranch, Hank's wife Susan was leading her horse out of a ring. She was blonde and attractive, but no pushover, tall, fit, and strong. Their daughters, Allie and Chris, aged 6 and 8, ran over to greet us, full of excitement that their dad was home and had brought a visitor. They scrambled into the minivan and joined us for a drive around the property. Hank wanted me to see the difference between his form of ranching and raping the land. As we took off onto a dirt road, I looked back at his house and thought about how small it looked amid this landscape. On acreage hundreds, if not thousands, of times larger than the front lawns and backyard surrounding the mansions of Colorado Springs, the family lived in a modest log cabin. Hank was practicing a form of range management inspired by the grazing patterns of elk and buffalo herds, animals who'd lived for millennia on this short grass prairie. His ranch was divided into 35 separate pastures. his cattle spent 10 or 11 days in one pasture, then were moved to the next, allowing the native plants, the blue grama and buffalo grass, time to recover. Hank stopped the minivan to show me a nearby stream. On land that has been overgrazed, the stream banks are usually destroyed first, as cattle gather in the cool shade beside the water, eating everything in sight. Hank's stream was fenced off with barbed wire, and the banks were lush and green. Then he took me to see Fountain Creek, which ran straight through the ranch, and I realized that he'd given other guests the same tour. It had a proper sequence and a point. Fountain Creek was a long, ugly gash, about 20 yards wide and 15 feet deep. The banks were collapsing from erosion. Fallen trees and branches littered the creek bed, and a small trickle of water ran down the middle. This was done by storm runoff from Colorado Springs, Hank said. The contrast between his impact on the land and the city's impact was hard to miss. The rapid growth of Colorado Springs had occurred without much official planning, zoning, or spending on drainage projects. As more pavement covered land within the city limits, more water flowed straight into Fountain Creek instead of being absorbed into the ground. The runoff from Colorado Springs eroded the land beside the creek, carrying silt and debris downstream all the way to Kansas. Hank literally lost part of his ranch every year. It got washed away by the city's rainwater. A nearby rancher once lost 10 acres of land in a single day, thanks to runoff from a fierce storm in Colorado Springs. While Hank stood on the crumbling bank, giving an impassioned speech about the watershed protection group that he'd helped to organize, telling me about holding ponds, landscaped greenways, and the virtues of permeable parking lots covered in gravel, I lost track of his words, and I thought, this guy's going to be governor of Colorado someday. Toward sunset, we spotted a herd of antelope and roared after them. That damn minivan bounced over the prairie like a horse at full gallop, Hank wild behind the wheel, Allie and Chris squealing in the back seat. We had a Chrysler engine, power steering, and disc brakes, but the antelope had a much superior grace, making sharp and unexpected turns, about 24 of them, bounding effortlessly, butts held high. After a futile chase, Hank let the herd go on its way, then veered right and guided the minivan up a low hill. There was something else he wanted to show me. The girls looked intently out the window, faces flushed, searching for more wildlife. When we reached the crest of the hill, I looked down and saw an immense oval structure, shiny and brand new. For an instant, I couldn't figure out what it was. It looked like a structure created by some alien civilization and plopped in the middle of nowhere. Stock car racing, Hank said matter-of-factly. The grandstands around the track were enormous, and so was the parking lot. Acres of black asphalt and white lines now spread across the prairie, thousands of empty spaces waiting for cars. The speedway was new, and races were being held there every weekend in the summer. You could hear the engines and the crowd from Hank's house. The races weren't the main problem, though. It was the practice runs that bothered Hank and Susan most. In the middle of the day, in one of America's most beautiful landscapes, they would suddenly hear the drone of stock cars going round and round. For a moment, we sat quietly on top of the hill, staring at the speedway bathed in twilight, at this oval strip of pavement, this unsettling omen. Hank stopped there long enough for me to ponder what it meant, the threat now coming his way, then drove back down the hill. The speedway was gone again, out of sight, and the girls were still happy in the back seat, chatting away, oblivious, as the sun dropped behind the mountains. Ranchers and cowboys have long been the central icons of the American West. Traditionalists have revered them as symbols of freedom and self-reliance. Revisionists have condemned them as racists, economic parasites, and despoilers of the land. The powerful feelings evoked by cattlemen reflect opposing views of our national identity, attempts to sustain old myths or create new ones. There is one indisputable fact, however, about American ranchers. They are rapidly disappearing. Over the last 20 years, about 500,000 ranchers sold off their cattle and quit the business. Many of the nation's remaining 800,000 ranchers are faring poorly. They're taking second jobs. They're selling cattle at break-even prices or at a loss. The ranchers who are faring the worst run 300 to 400 head of cattle, manage the ranch themselves, and live solely off the proceeds. The sort of hard-working ranchers long idealized in cowboy myths are the ones most likely to go broke today. Without receiving a fraction of the public attention given to the Northwestern spotted owl, America's independent cattlemen have truly become an endangered species. Ranchers currently face a host of economic problems: rising land prices, stagnant beef prices, oversupplies of cattle, increased shipments of live cattle from Canada and Mexico, development pressures, inheritance taxes, health scares about beef. On top of all that, the growth of the fast food chains has encouraged consolidation in the meatpacking industry. McDonald's is the nation's largest purchaser of beef. In 1968, McDonald's bought ground beef from 175 local suppliers. A few years later, seeking to achieve greater product uniformity as it expanded, McDonald's reduced the number of beef suppliers to 5. Much like the French fry industry, the meatpacking industry has been transformed by mergers and acquisitions over the last 20 years. Many ranchers now argue that a few large corporations have gained a stranglehold on the market, using unfair tactics to drive down the price of cattle. Anger toward the large meatpackers is growing, and a new range war threatens to erupt, one that will determine the social and economic structure of the rural West. A century ago, American ranchers found themselves in a similar predicament. The leading sectors of a nation's economy were controlled by corporate alliances known as trusts. There was a sugar trust, a steel trust, a tobacco trust, and a beef trust. It set the prices offered for cattle. Ranchers who spoke out against this monopoly power were often blackballed, unable to sell their cattle at any price. In 1917, at the height of the beef trust, the 5 largest meatpacking companies, Armour, Swift, Morris, Wilson, and Cudahy, controlled about 55% of the market. The early 20th century had trusts, but it also had trust busters, progressive government officials who believed that concentrated economic power posed a grave threat to American democracy. In 1917, President Woodrow Wilson ordered the Federal Trade Commission to investigate the industry. The FTC inquiry concluded that the 5 major meatpacking firms had secretly fixed prices for years, had colluded to divide up markets, and had shared livestock information to guarantee that ranchers received the lowest possible price for their cattle. Afraid that an antitrust trial might end with an unfavorable verdict, the 5 meatpacking companies signed a consent decree in 1920 that forced them to sell off their stockyards, retail meat stores, railway interests, and livestock journals. For the next 50 years, ranchers sold their cattle in a relatively competitive marketplace. The price of cattle was set through open bidding at auctions. The large meatpackers competed with hundreds of small regional firms. In 1970, the top 4 meatpacking firms slaughtered only 21% of the nation's cattle. A decade later, the Reagan administration allowed these firms to merge and combine without fear of antitrust enforcement. The Justice Department stood aside as the large meatpackers gained control of one local cattle market after another. Today, the top 4 meatpacking firms, Conagra, IBP, Excel, and National Beef, slaughter about 84% of the nation's cattle. Market concentration in the beef industry is now at the highest level since record-keeping began in the early 20th century. Today's unprecedented degree of meatpacking concentration has helped depress the prices that independent ranchers get for their cattle. over the last 20 years, the rancher's share of every retail dollar spent on beef has fallen from 63 cents to 46 cents. The four major meatpacking companies now control about 20% of the live cattle in the United States through captive supplies, cattle that are either maintained in company-owned feedlots or purchased in advance through forward contracts. When cattle prices start to rise, the large meatpackers can flood the market with their own captive supplies, driving prices back down. They can also obtain cattle through confidential agreements with wealthy ranchers, never revealing the true price being paid. ConAgra and Excel operate their own gigantic feedlots, while IBP has private arrangements with some of America's biggest ranchers and feeders, including J.R. Simplot. Independent ranchers and feedlots now have a hard time figuring out what their cattle are actually worth, let alone finding a buyer for them at the right price. On any given day in the nation's regional cattle markets, as much as 80% of the cattle being exchanged are captive supplies. The prices being paid for these cattle are never disclosed. To get a sense of what an independent rancher now faces, imagine how the New York Stock Exchange would function if large investors could keep the terms of all their stock trades secret. Ordinary investors would have no idea what their own stocks were really worth, a fact that wealthy traders could easily exploit. The large meatpacking firms have thus far shown little interest in buying their own cattle ranches. Why would they want the hassle? Lee Pitts, the editor of Livestock Market Digest, told me. Raising cattle is a business with a high overhead, and most of the capital's tied up in the land. Instead of buying their own ranches, the meatpacking companies have been financing a handful of large feedlot owners who lease ranches and run cattle for them. It's just another way of controlling prices through captive supply, Pitts explained. The packers now own some of these big feeders lock, stock, and barrel, and tell them exactly what to do. Many ranchers now fear that the beef industry is deliberately being restructured along the lines of the poultry industry. They do not want to wind up like chicken growers, who in recent years have become virtually powerless, trapped by debt and by onerous contracts written by the large processors. The poultry industry was also transformed by a wave of mergers in the 1980s. Eight chicken processors now control about two-thirds of the American market. These processors have shifted almost all of their production to the rural South, where the weather tends to be mild, the workforce is poor, unions are weak, and farmers are desperate to find some way of staying on their land. Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia, and Mississippi now produce more than half the chicken raised in the United States. Although many factors helped revolutionize the poultry industry and increase the power of the large processors, one innovation played an especially important role. The chicken McNugget turned a bird that once had to be carved at a table into something that could easily be eaten behind the wheel of a car. It turned a bulk agricultural commodity into a manufactured, value-added product. And it encouraged a system of production that has turned many chicken farmers into little more than serfs. I have an idea, Fred Turner, the chairman of McDonald's, told one of his suppliers in 1979. I want a chicken finger food without bones, about the size of your thumb. Can you do it? The supplier, an executive at Keystone Foods, ordered a group of technicians to get to work in the lab, where they were soon joined by food scientists from McDonald's. Poultry consumption in the United States was growing, a trend with alarming implications for a fast food chain that only sold hamburgers. The nation's chicken meat had traditionally been provided by hens that were too old to lay eggs. After World War II, a new poultry industry based in Delaware and Virginia lowered the cost of raising chicken, while medical research touted the health benefits of eating it. Fred Turner wanted McDonald's to sell a chicken dish that wouldn't clash with the chain's sensibility. After 6 months of intensive research, the Keystone Lab developed new technology for the manufacture of McNuggets, small pieces of reconstituted chicken, composed mainly of white meat that were held together by stabilizers, breaded, fried, frozen, then reheated. The initial test marketing of McNuggets was so successful that McDonald's enlisted another company, Tyson Foods, to guarantee an adequate supply. Based in Arkansas, Tyson was one of the nation's leading chicken processors, and it soon developed a new breed of chicken to facilitate the production of McNuggets. Dubbed Mr. McDonald, the new breed had unusually large breasts. Chicken McNuggets were introduced nationwide in 1983. Within 1 month of their launch, the McDonald's Corporation had become the second largest purchaser of chicken in the United States, surpassed only by KFC. McNuggets tasted good, they were easy to chew, and they appeared to be healthier than other items on the menu at McDonald's. After all, they were made out of chicken. But their health benefits were illusory. A chemical analysis of McNuggets by a researcher at Harvard Medical School found that their fatty acid profile more closely resembled beef than poultry. They were cooked in beef tallow, like McDonald's fries. The chain soon switched to vegetable oil, adding beef extract to McNuggets during the manufacturing process in order to retain their familiar taste. Chicken McNuggets, which became wildly popular among young children, still derive much of their flavor from beef additives and contain twice as much fat per ounce as a hamburger. The McNugget helped change not only the American diet, but also its system for raising and processing poultry. The impact of McNuggets was so huge that it changed the industry, the president of ConAgra Poultry, the nation's third largest chicken processor, later acknowledged. 20 years ago, most chicken was sold whole. Today, about 90% of the chicken sold in the United States has been cut into pieces, cutlets, or nuggets. In 1992, American consumption of chicken for the first time surpassed the consumption of beef. Gaining the McNugget contract helped turn Tyson Foods into the world's largest chicken processor. Tyson now manufactures about half of the nation's McNuggets and sells chicken to 90 of the 100 largest restaurant chains. It's a vertically integrated company that breeds, slaughters, and processes chicken. It does not, however, raise the birds. It leaves the capital expenditures and the financial risks of that task to thousands of independent contractors. A Tyson chicken grower never owns the birds in his or her poultry houses. Like most of the other leading processors, Tyson supplies its growers with one-day-old chicks. Between the day they're born and the day they're killed, the birds spend their entire lives on the grower's property. But they belong to Tyson. The company supplies the feed, veterinary services, and technical support. It determines feeding schedules, demands equipment upgrades, and employs flock supervisors to make sure that corporate directives are being followed. It hires the trucks that drop off the baby chicks and returns 7 weeks later to pick up full-grown chickens ready for slaughter. At the processing plant, Tyson employees count and weigh the birds. A grower's income is determined by a formula based upon that count, that weight, and the amount of feed used. The chicken grower provides the land, the labor, the poultry houses, and the fuel. Most growers must borrow money to build the houses, which cost about $150,000 each and hold about 25,000 birds. A 1995 survey by Louisiana Tech University found that the typical grower had been raising chicken for 15 years, owned 3 poultry houses, remained deeply in debt, and earned perhaps $12,000 a year. About half of the nation's chicken growers leave the business after just 3 years, either selling out or losing everything. The back roads of rural Arkansas are now littered with abandoned poultry houses. Most chicken growers cannot obtain a bank loan without already having a signed contract from a major processor. "We get the check first," a loan officer told the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. A chicken grower who is unhappy with his or her processor has little power to do anything about it. Poultry contracts are short-term. Growers who complain may soon find themselves with empty poultry houses and debts that still need to be paid. 25 years ago, when the United States had dozens of poultry firms, a grower stood a much better chance of finding a new processor and of striking a better deal. Today, growers who are labeled difficult often have no choice but to find a new line of work. A processor can terminate a contract with a grower whenever it likes. It owns the birds. Short of that punishment, a processor can prolong the interval between the departure of one flock and the arrival of another. Every day that poultry houses sit empty, the grower loses money. The large processors won't publicly disclose the terms of their contracts. In the past, such contracts have not only required that growers surrender all rights to file a lawsuit against the company, but have also forbidden them from joining any association that might link growers in a strong bargaining unit. The processors do not like the idea of chicken growers joining forces to protect their interests. Our relationship with our growers is a one-on-one contractual relationship, a Tyson executive told a reporter in 1998. We want to see that it remains that way. The four large meatpacking firms claim that an oversupply of beef, not any corporate behavior, is responsible for the low prices that American ranchers are paid for their cattle. A number of studies by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA, have reached the same conclusion. Annual beef consumption in the United States peaked in 1976 at about 94 pounds per person. Today, the typical American eats about 68 pounds of beef every year. Although the nation's population has grown since the 1970s, it has not grown fast enough to compensate for the decline in beef consumption. Ranchers trying to stabilize their incomes followed the advice of agribusiness firms and gave their cattle growth hormones. As a result, cattle are much bigger today. Fewer cattle are sold, and most American beef cannot be exported to the European Union, where the use of bovine growth hormones has been banned. The meatpacking companies claim that captive supplies and formula pricing systems are means of achieving greater efficiency, not of controlling cattle prices. Their slaughterhouses require a large and steady volume of cattle to operate profitably. Captive supplies are one reliable way of sustaining that volume. The large meatpacking companies say that they've become a convenient scapegoat for ranchers when the real problem is low poultry prices. A pound of chicken costs about half as much as a pound of beef. The long-term deals now being offered to cattlemen are portrayed as innovations that will save, not destroy, the beef industry. Responding in 1998 to a USDA investigation of captive supplies in Kansas, IBP defended such alternative methods for selling fed cattle. The company argued that these practices were similar to changes that have already occurred for selling other agricultural commodities, such as poultry. Many independent ranchers are convinced that captive supplies are used primarily to control the market, not to achieve greater slaughterhouse efficiency. They do not oppose large-scale transactions or long-term contracts. They oppose cattle prices that are kept secret. Most of all, they do not trust the meatpacking giants. The belief that agribusiness executives secretly talk on the phone with their competitors, set prices, and divide up the worldwide market for commodities, a belief widely held among independent ranchers and farmers, may seem like a paranoid fantasy. But that is precisely what executives at Archer Daniels Midland, supermarket to the world, did for years. Three of Archer Daniels Midland's top officials, including Michael Andreas, its vice chairman, were sent to federal prison in 1999 for conspiring with foreign rivals to control the international market for lysine, an important feed additive. The Justice Department's investigation of this massive price-fixing scheme focused on the period between August of 1992 and December of 1995. Within that roughly 3.5-year stretch, Archer Daniels Midland and its co-conspirators may have overcharged farmers by as much as $180 million. During the same period, Archer Daniels Midland executives also met with their overseas rivals to set the worldwide price for citric acid, a common food additive. At a meeting with Japanese executives that was secretly recorded, the president of Archer Daniels Midland preached the virtues of collaboration. "We have a saying at this company," he said, "our competitors are our friends, and our customers are our enemies." Archer Daniels Midland remains the world's largest producer of lysine, as well as the world's largest processor of soybeans and corn. It's also one of the largest shareholders of IBP. Ranchers in Colorado today, however, face threats to their livelihood that are unrelated to fluctuations in cattle prices. During the past 20 years, Colorado has lost roughly 1.5 million acres of ranch land to development. Population growth and the booming market for vacation homes have greatly driven up land costs. Some ranch land that sold for less than $200 an acre in the 1960s now sells for hundreds of times that amount. The new land prices make it impossible for ordinary ranchers to expand their operations. Each head of cattle needs about 30 acres of pasture for grazing. And until cattle start producing solid gold nuggets instead of sirloin, it's hard to sustain beef production on such expensive land. Ranching families in Colorado tend to be land rich and cash poor. Inheritance taxes can claim more than half of a cattle ranch's land value. Even if a family manages to operate its ranch profitably, handing it down to the next generation may require selling off large chunks of land, thereby diminishing its productive capacity. Along with the ranches, Colorado is quickly losing its ranching culture. Among the students at Harrison High, you see a variety of fashion statements: gangsta wannabes, skaters, stoners, goths, and punks. What you don't see, in the shadow of Pikes Peak, in the heart of the Rocky Mountain West, is anyone dressed even remotely like a cowboy. Nobody's wearing shirts with snaps or Justin boots. In 1959, 8 of the nation's top 10 TV shows were Westerns. The networks ran 35 Westerns in primetime every week, and places like Colorado, where real cowboys lived, were the stuff of youthful daydreams. That America now seems as dead and distant as the England of King Arthur. The median age of Colorado's ranchers and farmers is about 55. And roughly half of the state's open land will change hands during the next two decades, a potential boon for real estate developers. A number of Colorado land trusts are now working to help ranchers obtain conservation easements. In return for donating future development rights to one of these trusts, a rancher receives an immediate tax break and the prospect of lower inheritance taxes. The land remains private property, but by law can never be turned into golf courses, shopping malls, or subdivisions. In 1995, the Colorado Cattlemen's Association formed the first land trust in the United States that is devoted solely to the preservation of ranch land. It has thus far protected almost 40,000 acres, a significant achievement. But ranch land in Colorado is now vanishing at the rate of about 90,000 acres a year. Conservation easements are usually of greatest benefit to wealthy gentleman ranchers who earn large incomes from other sources. The doctors, lawyers, and stockbrokers now running cattle on some of Colorado's most beautiful land can own big ranches, preserve open space with easements, and enjoy the big tax deductions. Ranchers whose annual income comes entirely from selling cattle usually don't earn enough to benefit from that sort of tax break. And the value of their land, along with the pressure to sell it, often increases when a wealthy neighbor obtains a conservation easement, since the views in the area are more likely to remain unspoiled. The Colorado ranchers who now face the greatest economic difficulty are the ones who run a few hundred head of cattle, who work their own land, who don't have any outside income, and who don't stand to gain anything from a big tax write-off. they have to compete with gentlemen ranchers whose operations don't have to earn a profit, and with part-time ranchers whose operations are kept afloat by second jobs. Indeed, the ranchers most likely to be in financial trouble today are the ones who live the life and embody the values supposedly at the heart of the American West. They are independent and self-sufficient, cherish their freedom, believe in hard work, and as a result, are now paying the price. Hank died in 1998. He took his own life the week before Christmas. He was 43. When I heard the news, it made no sense to me, none at all. The man that I knew was full of fire and ready to go. The kind of person who seemed always to be throwing himself into the middle of things. He did not hide away. He got involved in the community, served on countless boards and committees. He had a fine sense of humor. He loved his family. The way he died seemed to contradict everything else about his life. It would be wrong to say that Hank's death was caused by the consolidating and homogenizing influence of the fast food chains, by monopoly power in the meatpacking industry, by depressed prices in the cattle market, by the economic forces bankrupting independent ranchers, by the tax laws that favor wealthy ranchers, by the unrelenting push of Colorado's real estate developers. But it would not be entirely wrong. Hank was under enormous pressure at the time of his death. He was trying to find a way of gaining conservation easements that would protect his land, but not sacrifice the financial security of his family. Cattle prices had fallen to their lowest point in more than a decade, and El Paso County was planning to build a new highway right through the heart of his ranch. The stress of these things and others led to sleepless nights, then to a depression that spiraled downward fast, and before long, he was gone. The suicide rate among ranchers and farmers in the United States is now about 3 times higher than the national average. The issue briefly received attention during the 1980s farm crisis, but has been pretty much ignored ever since. Meanwhile, across rural America, a slow and steady death toll mounts. As the rancher's traditional way of life is destroyed, so are many of the beliefs that go with it. The code of the rancher could hardly be more out of step with America's current state of mind. In Silicon Valley, entrepreneurs and venture capitalists regard failure as just a first step toward success. After 3 failed internet startups, there's still a chance that the 4th one will succeed. What's being sold ultimately matters less than how well it sells. In ranching, a failure is much more likely to be final. The land that has been lost is not just a commodity. It has meaning that cannot be measured in dollars and cents. It's a tangible connection with the past, something that was meant to be handed down to children and never sold. As Osha Gray Davidson observes in his book, Broken Heartland, 1996, to fail several generations of relatives, to see yourself as the one weak link in a strong chain is a terrible and for some an unbearable burden. When Hank was 8 years old, he was the subject of a children's book. It combined text with photographs and told the story of a boy's first roundup. Young Hank wears blue jeans and a black hat in the book, rides a white horse, tags along with real cowboys, stares down a herd of cattle in a corral. You can see in these pictures why Hank was chosen for the part. His face is lively and expressive. He can ride, he can lasso, and he looks game, willing to jump a fence or chase after a steer 10 times his size. The boy in the story starts out afraid of animals on the ranch, but in the end conquers his fear of cattle, snakes, and coyotes. There's a happy ending, and the final image echoes the last scene of a classic Hollywood Western, affirming the spirit of freedom and independence. Accompanied by an older cowhand and surrounded by a herd of cattle, young Hank rides his white horse across a vast, wide-open prairie, heading toward the horizon. In life, he did not get that sort of ending. He was buried at his ranch, in a simple wooden coffin made by friends. Cogs in the Great Machine. You can smell Greeley, Colorado, long before you can see it. The smell is hard to forget, but not easy to describe. A combination of live animals, manure, and dead animals being rendered into dog food. The smell is worst during the summer months, blanketing Greeley day and night like an invisible fog.